Really?
Oh, we got special guests?
Come on.
Bring him in.
Join.
Special guest,
Mateo Keeler.
Mateo Keeler.
We just had you on the radio.
Yeah. When did that run?
Let's see.
7 hours ago.
Seven hours ago.
Yeah.
I was just on the radio.
I'm on the radio again. I was the guy calling you.
Yeah. Awesome.
Mateo.
It was incredible.
Sellers at Jasper Hill.
Yes.
Here, Mateo, sit here.
So, Mateo, how are you doing tonight? You having a good time?
Oh, I'm having a great time.
So, what is your role in all this? How are you participating?
In this particular event tonight?
This fete?
I'm
a reveler?
A reveler, and my appearance is random, which is what makes it even more interesting.
Let me backtrack. What is your relation to Roberta's, and what do you do?
I work closely with Anne Saxelby.
Cheesemonger, hello.
Cutting the curd Sundays.
3:30.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm a cheesemaker, and I also ripen cheese for 13 other cheesemakers, and I have some pigs, and that's where the conversation with Patrick gets interesting for us. Pigs.
Pigs.
Yeah.
So, what is your whole part and your approach in this whole sustainability that we're talking about tonight? Because, the whole point of being here tonight is raising money for the rooftop garden for Roberta's, and the hot topic tonight has been sustainability and moving forward and switching a mainstream culture depending on processed foods to a more, I hate using the word green because it's been so bastardized now, but the whole, right for the environment? We'll go with that. No catchphrase.
Well, the whole bent of our business is sustainability, and we come at sustainability from the angle of economic viability. We consider ourselves to be economic engineers. We engineer the mechanisms to keep our landscape working and productive, to keep people on the land, keep the landscape beautiful. We're architects in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And, the way that we've approached this is, taking a step back, identifying the elements that contribute in a meaningful way to both the culture, agriculture, human culture, and their interface with the land, and what kind of investments in infrastructure can we make to continue to keep that landscape working.
What you were saying on the show about the cellars being like bank vaults, if you will, and these investments keep growing, I mean, that was something that really touched on that.
Exactly.
This economic viability, this forward thing, moving.
So how do we distill the fat of the land? Mm-hmm. And in the most simple way, by turning grass into milk and milk into cheese and cheese into money?
Right, exactly.
Boom.
Why don't you just explain one more time briefly the concept of the cellars and what it means for you guys?
Well, the cellars at Jasper Hill is 22,000 square foot underground series of vaulted cellars that we use to ripen cheese for, at this point, 13 cheesemakers in Vermont. We have capacity for about 40 cheesemakers. Our goal is to double the number of cheesemakers in Vermont, basically as a means of keeping the landscape working. Mm. We provide a bundle of services to cheesemakers, everything from plant facility design to technical assistance on recipes to aging cheese, because cheese is the original store of value. It increases in value over time the way that capital is supposed to. The Swiss and Italian banking industries grew up with their cheese industries. Reggiano is a, when the banks, the Italian banks got bailed out, it was like a major infusion to the Reggiano industry.
I have a question. Do these farmers that you help age their cheese, do they then sell it under the Jasper Hills name, or do they have their own name at the same time?
No, we co-brand everything we do. We're pretty committed to transparency, and one of the things that we provide for the producers we work with is actual branding.
Helping them market.
Exactly. So yeah. we provide aging services, mm-hmm. Marketing, sales, and distribution services, and we actually finance and cash flow their businesses by paying them for their cheese up front and early.
So it's a commitment.
It's a partnership, yeah.
And even if their cheese is in real estate for 24 months, you've already told them that you're going to help them sell it 2 years down the road.
Sure. We actually buy it 2 years before we sell it.
What's the longest aging process you guys do?
The longest aged cheese we've got is about 18 months. It's going to be like a traditional English-style cloth-bound cheddar, Cabot cloth-bound cheddar. We also make a cloth-bound cheddar called Aspenhurst.
And which is what helped make this all possible, no?
Exactly. It's a collaboration with Vermont's largest cheesemakers and their smallest cheesemakers. The smallest cheesemaker we work with is Hope Farm. They milk 40 sheep. So we kind of we have a little something to offer everybody. Thinking about Roberta's, you know, an interesting thing that's happening in our community, we have something called a community supported restaurant called Claire's in Hardwick, Vermont, and they raised about $100,000 from the community in $1,000 increments that are redeemed in $25 monthly discounts
for the restaurant.
So, my family, we paid $1,000 and every month we go have dinner and drinks and we get a $25 discount. And over the course of 2 years, we get our $1,000 back.
That's
great. Now, as a novice of cheese aging,
yep.
What does aging cheese do? Because a lot of people know what aging wine does.
Sure.
But most people don't think of cheese as an aged thing, even though most cheeses that you get at a gourmet level have aged in some sense.
Well, cheese is milk's leap towards immortality, right? So, you know.
That's a good line.
What we do is... We have five different environments. We have seven vaulted cellars, and depending on the style of cheese, whether it's a washed rind cheese, bloomy rinded cheese, like aged cheddar alpine style cheese, it goes into a particular environment. The cheeses will get washed, turned, brushed, vacuumed, whatever the treatment might be for a prescribed amount of time until a cheese reaches its peak flavor. And basically what's happening is fat and protein are being degraded by enzymes produced by lactic acid producing bacteria, and proteins being converted into flavor. And when that process can take anywhere from a few days to a few years, depending on the moisture and pH and whatnot of the cheese. So we're basically tending to these products over the course of time and coaxing flavor out of them.
Now, and like how wine would be aged in, let's say, maybe an oak barrel as opposed to something else, is there an element that you're adding into some of these cellars that's changing the flavor or adding to the flavor of these cheeses as they age?
Sure. The amount of air exchange, the temperature, the humidity. We wash cheeses with beer, ice cider, ice wine, liqueurs, straight brines. All those things can have a real impact on, the flavor and trajectory of a cheese.
What do you, fall season, what's your ideal slice of cheese and then accompaniment?
Standard this time of year, we got 3 inches of snow in Vermont this morning up on the farm.
Oh, my God. Jeez.
Already?
It is too early to think about snow.
Oh,
yeah.
Scary.
Here we go.
Denver just got hit this weekend the first time.
Yeah, and, hard freeze, 22, 23 degrees. So as we get into, the colder weather, one of my personal favorites is grilled Bailey Hazen blue and bacon sandwiches with like red onions and some kind of a chutney.
And what type of beer are you drinking?
I'm drinking a 6-point Bengali IPA.
Yeah, that's what I had earlier. It's
pretty good.
It's damn good.
So we're talking tonight about a lot of people starting out. If you wanted to start making or aging your own cheese, which is a totally big to do. How do you get your start? Where do you, you don't, it's not like a, I'm going to plant a farm. It's how do you become a cheesemonger or a cheese ripener, if you will?
Oh boy, the cheese ripening thing is pretty complex. You know, I get this question all the time. It really is a commitment to a way of life. It's if you're going to be a farmstead cheesemaker, particularly, you know, it never ends. We make cheese 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It just never ends. So you're never done. You never, it's never over. We basically jumped into this from day one with no real conception of what it really meant. So how do you prepare for something that there's no way you can possibly understand?
Yeah.
I went to Europe and made cheese in England, France, and Spain for a couple of years. But there's nothing like...
Trial by fire.
Yeah.
So it's not... I mean, cheeses are really respected. I mean, all over the world, I mean, if you can really think about...
We are mammals. It is the ultimate food.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, if you think about things that are sort of unifying in a lot of cultures that are respected for the culinary achievements, cheese and bread...
Yeah,
really. Yeah, I mean, you can sort of, in some form, you can judge a culture by that.
Yeah,
And it seems today that most people can bake their own bread. You know, you spend enough time in the kitchen, you understand what a salt, egg, water, flour combo. But cheese is still this ultimate. Cheese is sort of like the holy grail, if you will, of the culinary world, because you know you can't really go to the FCI and be like, I'm going to take a cheese course and really come out a cheesemonger. It's really still that same apprenticeship.
Yeah.
And I guess I don't want to say shortcuts. I mean, shortcuts isn't the right word.
There are none.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's interesting, though. The thing I find interesting is that charcuterie has picked up here in America a lot.
Of course.
Now people are, you know, taking fresh bellies and turning them into bacon by hanging them in their kitchen. So we've kind of, like, begun to master charcuterie a little bit here.
Yes.
The next thing, like you were saying there, is cheese. How can we get started? I mean, is there a way to do it in your kitchen or basement?
People make their own ricotta now.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's definitely making ricotta is not a... It's... Oh my God, anymore. Yeah. But, you know, we're talking legitimate cheese out of the fridge. Can you at home?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you know, people have been making cheese for thousands of years. Most of it probably isn't that good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're going to be an exceptional cheesemaker, it is a commitment and a lifestyle. If you want to make cheese in your kitchen, you can totally do that, and lots of people are. You can pick up molds, starter cultures. You can make yourself a tremendous mess in your kitchen.
Is this still something at that level that most people would just fail at first time?
Honestly. No need to be modest. I think
you can make a perfectly mediocre product the first time.
Okay.
You know?
That's encouraging.
Yeah, really.
Hey, I mean, think about the first time you made pasta.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Oh, my God. Macaroni and cheese. That's what it was like.
Yeah.
Out of a box.
You throw it at the wall. Does it stick?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. No. I think it's perfectly possible. And it's all about fermentation, and fermentation isn't necessarily a simple thing. You know, I always say that being a cheesemaker is like being a god, except you're blind and stupid, because you're creating these universes and like setting these worlds in motion that you can't see. You can see the effects of acidification. You can see the effects of all this bacterial soup. And then you're like, you're ending it. You're like salting and draining and drying and, you know, just wiping out like entire populations with, you know, a stroke. And it's easy if you don't understand what's going on to really kind of, you know, mess things up. But if you start off with great milk, all you can do.
That's the base.
Yeah, is mess it up. You know, it's milk and cheese specifically really comes down to your cheese will never be better than your milk. In a sense, you know, it's not an art; it's a craft.
You're just refining the taste.
Exactly.
And everything you put into it is important.
You know, and you've got four ingredients, but.
Which are?
You know, milk, bacterial starter cultures, rennet, salt.
Okay.
All cheeses have the same ingredients.
And can you purchase this? Where would you purchase all four at the same place? A farm? Is that the only place to get all this?
Well, the milk is obviously going to be coming from a farm, but...
And you want to source the best milk, as you said.
Exactly, because your cheese will never be better than your milk.
Okay.
That's like the cardinal rule of cheese making. But... like the rest of the ingredients are available at places like New England Cheesemaking Supply. Ricky Carroll has been supplying home cheesemakers forever. Glengarry Cheesemaking in Ontario has a whole business supplying home cheesemakers. You can buy this stuff online. Dairy Connections in Wisconsin, you know, over the internet. If you Google like cheesemaking supplies, you can get molds, you can get rennet, you can get starter culture, and if you can find good milk...
And I'm sorry, rennet is...
Rennet is a coagulant, an enzyme, originally from the abomasum, the fourth stomach of an unweaned calf, and cheesemaking really is about mimicking the way that a calf digests milk. We're capturing solids and, you know... expelling liquid, and you end up with cheese in the end, fermented milk.
Can I ask? Can we go social gossip for 1 second? What is the cheese? What are cheese people society like? Is it a jovial, harmonious? I'm in it bunch, or is it a catty? My cheese is snootier than your cheese type of society.
Oh, we have it all.
Yeah,
we've got it all. I mean,
rivalries. We got rivalries.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you got rivalries. You've got great partnerships and collaborations. I'm heading from New York back to the farm tomorrow, and I'm taking Andy Hatch, who's here tonight. He's the cheesemaker at Uplands. He makes Pleasant Ridge Reserve, one of the best cheeses in the United States, if not the world. He's coming back up to make cheese with me at our place. So, you know, you have it all. You've got the old school who don't necessarily want anything to do, that struggled and, you know, fought to get where they are, started 25, 30 years ago. And you've got upstarts like us that just, like, pop up on the scene and, like...
Is there love?
Yeah.
Is there love old school, new school?
You know, the interesting thing about this for me is, like, what happens in Vermont, what we have in Vermont is pretty unique. If you look at a place like California,
yeah,
where the cheesemakers are much larger, these are like big businesses.
Like Coaches, right?
Coaches, I think they're pretty big. I've never.
They do all the goat.
Got. I think I'm not sure if they're buying milk or buying curd or.
I mean, I know that they start. The story is they started off as a small farm.
Yeah.
But now they're so. I mean, who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? Because they're so big. You know, I guess there's that same mystery in like large forming cheese.
Exactly.
As there is in like large agriculture.
And you know the transition from artisan to industrial.
Small
production.
Gray line or big
it's,
jump?
It's no, I think it's going gray all the time, which
so,
is
so. What do you do? I mean, and this is. I mean, we keep going back to this topic the entire night. But what's going to take for me to go to the store and I want cheese for my family, and I see the $2.99 whatever cheese versus the $7.99. gourmet cheese, and you know, you could taste the difference. That's the beautiful thing about cheese. You know the difference and things like that. Cheese doesn't lie. But what do you do to make that shift, or what is the future going to hold where something like that shift where you're getting artisanal cheese that's healthy and processed, and it's more natural for your body than this, you know, big block of yellow dye. Like, what do you do to make that price happen without the government coming in with taxes and regulations and things like that? Is there an answer?
Well, we're working on it by trying to create efficiencies and economies of scale where they make sense, like packing, shipping, and, you know, distribution on the aging side as well, while decentralizing the actual cheese making and making cheese with efficient modern equipment on the farm. You know, we're competing with industrial artisan cheese from France and Italy, and just because it's imported doesn't mean that it's quote-unquote artisan.
Right.
That's what we're up against. And how do you compete with that on price? Well, you compete on quality first, and you make the investments in infrastructure and equipment to get you there, while maintaining the soul of a product by making sure that it's tied to the land.
I mean, it's a beautiful sentiment. I agree with, and that's the thing. I feel if you take it's, you know, processed cheese is a total, it's not even real food.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's totally different. But I guess it's just that thing of just like the belief in infrastructure and quality at some point is just not right now going to fight out the Got Milk lobbyists.
No.
Who, I mean, let's be honest. The Got Milk people, I mean, that is factory farming,
yeah,
and dairy culture.
And they've got the money. But here we are, and we're all voting with our forks.
No,
right?
I totally believe it. But, you know, there's the vote with your fork.
A movement going on.
Totally.
Here.
Yeah. And one thing I'd like to ask, have you heard of, you know, any like science experiments? You know how kids in middle school, they have to come up with a science project? Is any child that you know of in Vermont, in your community, where cheese making is like so strong, to try and make their own cheese for a science project for school?
Well, I do something with the sixth grade class at our elementary school every year,
okay,
where I come in and make cheese,
mm-hmm,
and use cheese making as a means of teaching math and science, because there's quite a bit of math involved in cheese making, believe it or not, multiplication and division, and, you know, actually measuring the time that it takes rennet to flocculate to gel the milk, and then, you know, calculating a set time, and
it would be a super advanced science project.
Yeah, and
them
measuring pH and, you know, plotting curves and stuff like that.
Very nice.
So that's, I do that with our elementary school sixth grade class every year. It's great fun.
Do you take out apprentices? Do people come?
Yep.
Has you seen growth over like the last year with the a lot of people who have seen taking up food and hobbies as a answer to the recession? Have you seen a growth in people who are just like, I just want to learn how to make cheese. I just want to learn how to do this.
There's a lot of people that want something real.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I totally get you.
You know, it's like
something tangible, numbers on a page.
Exactly. And it's like the whole global charade starts coming apart at the seams, and people want something real.
Well, I mean, how much, you know, squeeze the teat, get some milk, make some cheese.
Yeah. It's primal.
It's primal.
Yeah.
But is your demand still more than your supply right now?
Yeah. At this point, you know, we, our sales, and our capacity for sales is, are growing, exponentially. The credit crunch and all that,
mm-hmm,
has affected us. There's less money,
mm-hmm,
out there, which means that people are, paying, you know, we're not sure if we're affected or not, because,
mm-hmm,
we're in a startup phase.
Mm-hmm.
But my sense is that where people were once willing to pay $25, $30 a pound for cheese, that's not the case anymore.
Well, not at a mass, but there are still, there's still a small niche.
Yeah, it's, and it's getting smaller.
Really?
But that's okay. You know, I mean, what we're really about is creating access to high quality food for people in the middle.
Okay. I guess that really is a new challenge across the board of just responding to this true middle class who still remembers and desires a gourmet taste, but at the end of the day, they can't afford, like you said, the 25 to 30 pound. Does that affect, does that go into the process when you, moving forward, what cheeses you're going to ripen because you only have X amount of space, what cultures you're going to pass? I mean, does that come into a factor of being like, okay, well, X amount of people were really going to be able to afford this, and then we can still hit the high end.
Sure. We just brought a farm on this year that's making a Caerphilly-style cheese. It's a raw milk farmstead cheese that is hitting the marketplace at about half of what most cheeses are going for on the counter. And that's we're able to do that because of the model that we built, and you know, the dairy farmers capturing the value on at the farm gate, didn't have to make the investment in the aging infrastructure, didn't have to hire staff to ripen the product, didn't have to build a marketing, sales, and distribution.
Infrastructure is key.
And because we have this piece of infrastructure, we're able to get products to the market.
You set up a system.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in place, and now you could bring people on as you choose and when it's worth it. And
we just need cheesemakers now.
Wow.
Are you really that, like, if you could say, like, here's a call, we want cheesemakers?
Yeah, how long do they have to stay on with you for?
Well, it's, you know, it's a, the thing about being a cheesemaker is you have to have the temperament, you have to have the intelligence, you have to have the work ethic, and you have to have, you know.
And how did these people get in touch with you? Tell us.
Mateo, Mateo at jasperhillfarm.com.
Okay, because I mean, I know people that would love an opportunity. I mean, it's passion too.
So in the hierarchy of temperament, chef is beneath bread maker beneath farmer, farmer beneath cheesemonger. Is cheesemonger the penultimate, like, temperament that you need, or is it like cheesemaker, winemaker?
Well, the thing about winemaking is that in cheesemaking you have a vintage every day.
Touché.
Which in some ways makes it a lot easier and others a lot more complicated because it's relentless. With winemaking you get maybe 25, 30 chances. With cheesemaking, the opportunity to learn is huge, but the complexity of the learning, you know, there's a lot more moving parts in cheese. So, you know, I would say that I'm not sure that I would order them in any particular way because, you know, it really it's not that linear, but cheesemaking is just relentless. So it's like a Buddhist exercise for, it's the way that I approach it. It's like an exercise in consciousness over time, because what really matters you can't see. You can only see the effects of your actions. You can't actually and if you're making an aged cheese, you know, you might not see the effects of your actions for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 months.
Right.
So the learning curve can be imperceptible if you're not really paying attention.
Can I ask one last question before I take up any more of your time? You're on a desert island, one cheese, rest of your life. What's the perfect?
The perfect cheese. Boy, I think it'd have to be something like a Gruyere-like cheese. Something that, you know, something that you could eat a lot of every day that's not too salty. Something that's got flavor that melts well. Something that's versatile and holds up in the desert heat.
Good answer.
All right, well, thank you. We're talking to Mateo from
Jasper Hills.
Jasper Hills. If you want to get into more ideas about cheesemaking and become a cheesemonger yourself, that's Mateo, M-A-T-E-O, at jasperhills.com.
Jasper Hill Farm.
I'm sorry, jasperhillfarm.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are coming at you live from Roberta's, 261 Moore Street. It is the fundraiser to build the next rooftop garden. Sustainability is the name of the game. Come on down. We're doing auctions. We're drinking beer. Throw 20 bucks in the hat. You know you can do it.
Yeah, we'll be here all night.
Be here all night. All right.
Awesome.
So, Heritage Radio Network. And a big shout out again to TechServe for sponsoring us.
Thanks, guys.
Go Roberta's.